Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR, Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Global financial markets on high alert today. Last week, a deal sealed to raise the U.S. debt ceiling a day before a potential default. Then a 700-point drop on the New York Stock Exchange, an unprecedented downgrade of the country's once untouchable credit rating. Now we may be on the brink of another recession, and there is ample blame to go around. This hour on Point, former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers on what's gone wrong and what can be done. You can join the conversation. Did this country deserve the S&P downgrade? What do you see coming now? How do we fix this mess? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Truro, Massachusetts, is former U.S. Treasury Secretary under Bill Clinton, Lawrence Summers, former Chief Economist at the World Bank, former President of Harvard University, Chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors to President Barack Obama until the end of last year, outspoken, controversial, and always plugged in. Larry Summers, welcome back to On Point.
Glad to be with you, Tom.
Are we on the verge of another meltdown here, 08 style?
I think it's unlikely. Policy has the tools necessary to contain problems that exist. Obviously, there are issues of political will and political capacity to act in both the United States and in Europe. But my expectation would be that in the United States, this will be a turbulent period, but there is no reason why the kind of events we saw in 2008 would have to unfold.
We'll look at the long-term picture, but right now, reports of all weekend long, you know, big global phone conferences by top Treasury officials from around the world. What's your eye on right now? What bouncing ball, are you following in all this unease, to say the least?
I don't think there's any single ball you can follow, Tom. Obviously, one watches what's happened in U.S. markets, and U.S. markets have, in a sense, given their view, which reflected the views of most of the experts who commented on the Sunday shows, that S&P's judgment is not something that any great weight should be assigned to. Indeed, the day after a downgrade, U.S. Treasuries have rallied significantly today. So I think we've seen an answer to a first question, which is the S&P judgment itself going to have a large effect? There are, I think, several other things that are of concern. The economy certainly appears more fragile than it appeared two or three months ago, and the risks of a slowdown or even the possibility of a double dip have increased. And the situation in Europe has become much more serious in recent weeks. For most of the time we have been talking about Europe, the main issues were centered on Portugal, Greece, and Ireland, significant economies to be sure, but not large relative to the European economy as a whole, and certainly not relative to the global economy. What we've seen in the last several weeks is a virulent spread to Spain and Italy of the problems. And as the number of countries that need rescuing rise relative to the number of countries in a position to provide the rescue, the risks in Europe increase. And that's an important source of uncertainty for markets at this point.
You've said in recent days, Lawrence Summers, that you see a 1 in 3 chance of another recession, the double dip, as you say. Now, that was a couple of days ago. I don't know if that ratio has changed since then. What are the odds that we head back into recession now? Could we already be into a new recession? And what's the toggle switch or switches that are most important in determining whether we go into another recession or not?
Tom, I think I said that the chances were 1 in 3 with no new policy actions. And the policy choices that we make in the United States going forward are going to be very important. It would be a grave mistake to allow the payroll tax cut that was put in place this year that's provided important source support to spending for American families, to allow that payroll tax cut to expire at the end of the year, as the current budget agreement does if no new actions are taken, would, in my judgment, be a serious mistake.
Because that would reduce demand, spending capacity.
Reduce spending and demand at a time when the economy desperately needs more demand. It is an ongoing failure that we are not doing more to invest in our country's infrastructure. I happen to come on a report that the state of Nevada does as it talks about evaluating projects, where they estimate that delaying a highway repair project by 2 years can increase its cost by a factor of 5. It is madness that at a time when the interest rate is below 2.5% for the government to borrow for 10 years in its own currency, at a time when construction unemployment in some areas approaches 20%, that we are not putting more people to work, making these kinds of highly productive investments.
But does that mean you're calling for another round of stimulus, Larry?
I'm calling for, you can call what you like, but I'm certainly calling for both support for household spending, and I'm calling for increased public spending, not on broad new programs, but on doing things like performing routine maintenance expenditures that have been deferred far too long. Tom, you know, when you borrow money, you cheat future generations. When you defer maintenance, you cheat future generations. When you commit pension liabilities and you don't fund them, you cheat future generations. When you don't do anything about festering environmental problems, you cheat future generations. We need to take a broader view of this whole deficit issue and look to the consequences of all the things that we're doing for the future.
But
the most important thing I believe we can do for the future is to get this economy growing. Because, you know, if we increase the growth rate of the economy over the next decade by even 0.5%, that's $1.6 trillion on the cumulative deficit over 10 years. That's much more than was achieved in this most recent agreement.
And, of course, if the economic growth falls by 0.5%, I assume it's greater deficit in the other direction.
Absolutely.
You know, by your definition, there's already a lot of cheating that's gone on. I mean, we've already deferred a lot of infrastructure. We've already put together pensions that are not funded. We've already done almost everything on your litany of cheating steps. And S&P's explanation for its downgrade, the one that it emphasized, was the political inability of this country to get its hands around the challenges that it's facing. Is S&P right in that regard?
Nobody can think that the U.S. political system has had a good couple of months. The fact that you have serious political leaders really saying that they would rather see the economy, see the United States of America default on its debt than not get their way. The fact that you have congressional leaders who aren't even willing to sit and negotiate with the president but keep walking away from the table. The fact that at a time when the president of the United States, who has strong policy preferences, makes clear that he's willing to discuss all options, that you have a determined minority that simply rules some options completely off the table, all of this has to be dispiriting with respect to our political process. But if you ask, does it translate into a realistic threat that the United States is going to be unable to service its debts, we've got debt ratios that are lower than many other countries who have AAA ratings. I do not expect it to come to this at all, but it's always worth remembering that a country that borrows in its own currency and can print more of that currency fundamentally would in extremis, have a much easier time avoiding default than a country that doesn't print the currency in which it borrows. And so for all those reasons, I don't think there's much foundation for a judgment that the United States should leave the ranks of the countries least likely to default. And the fact that, rather remarkably, there are substantial safe haven flows into U.S. Treasuries this morning bears out what it is that I am saying.
Of course.
I mean, a simple way for your listeners to think about this is the guys at S&P are saying that it's time to sell U.S. bonds. Warren Buffett is saying it's time to buy U.S. bonds. Who would you bet on?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Here yesterday in an interview with CNBC's John Harwood, Treasury Secretary current Timothy Geithner ripped Standard & Poor's after the ratings agency downgraded U.S. debt.
I think S&P has shown really terrible judgment, and they've handled themselves very poorly, and they've shown a stunning lack of knowledge about basic U.S. fiscal budget math. And I think they drew exactly the wrong conclusion from this budget agreement.
Stunning lack of judgment. We have former U.S. Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers with us today. Standard & Poor's was not stepping back from its judgment. Here's Managing Director John Chambers speaking Sunday to ABC's This Week about that downgrade, saying it's been a long time in the making.
We've been saying for some time that the fiscal trajectory of the United States was on a bad path and that the political gridlock in Washington leads us to conclude that policymakers don't have the ability to proactively, put the public finances of the U.S. on a sustainable footing. We said that in April. We said that again in July. We think our message has been pretty consistent, and we also think that the numbers speak for themselves.
The USA no longer AAA. We're talking today with former Treasury Secretary and top economic advisor to President Barack Obama, Lawrence Summers, about the economy in a time of crisis. What got us here? What gets us out? He's former, you name it, president of Harvard University, chief economist for the IMF, and chairman of the economic advisors to Barack Obama, many other positions. Larry Summers, we've got lots of callers for you. If we may, let's go right to Nancy in Manchester, Vermont. Nancy, you're on with the former U.S. Treasury Secretary.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Pretty well. What do you think?
I'm angry. I've been angry for a long time, and I think we did deserve it because our politicians are going against what the American people want, and they have no idea what it means to work every day and to have to struggle. I own a business in Manchester, Vermont,
yep.
And this last recession nearly drove us into the ground. We're in business for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I have 12 people that work for us. And if we go into another recession, I don't know if we'll make it.
What do the American people want, though, Nancy? You say they're ignoring it. What is it? Is it the Tea Party solution, cut all the spending, cut cap and balance, all that, or steady as she goes?
Being fair. And, John Boehner said he stuck his neck out a mile. He didn't do anything. There was no compromise on any regard for what the left side wanted. The Republicans got everything, and, I work hard every day, and it's just amazing that people are starving, they have no food, they have no jobs. I have people coming in asking for work all the time, and my heart goes out to them because I know just how difficult it is. Winter is around the corner, and I think we truly deserved it because our politicians are just, all they're interested in is being reelected and lining their pockets, and they're not willing to help the public.
Nancy, let us hold it right there. You've said a lot. Larry Summers, she's got a business. She's got 12 employees. She doesn't want to have to let them go. It sounds like it's been touch and go, another recession, and she says that's what will happen. And she thinks Standard & Poor's is right. Our politicians have not shown, a capacity to fix the necessary.
Look, I agree very much with the things the caller said. I think the jobs deficit, the growth deficit, is our biggest problem in the near term. I think the caller's disgust with a lot of what has happened in Washington is warranted. I think that it's businesses like the caller's businesses that ultimately give me strength as to the foundation of the American economy. Your caller recognized, and I think she was right, that the failure to compromise was a bit of a one-sided problem. The president was prepared to negotiate as long as anyone wanted to. He was never the one who left the table. The House majority left the table three times. The president was open to a balanced approach. Indeed, the president's preferred approach laid out in April involves three times as much in spending cuts as it does in revenue increases.
Mm-hmm.
But the House majority is determined to see no revenue increases, even though that last bit of expenditure cutting will be brutal. It could mean as many as 20 million people losing health care benefits, could mean reductions of a quarter or a third in research and development and education.
You mean what's got to be negotiated by this congressional super committee this fall?
The preferred Republican plan as laid out by Congressman Ryan would have the implications that that I just said. You can mitigate them if you don't choose this as a moment for major tax cutting. You can mitigate those consequences if you are prepared to raise taxes, not on most Americans, but on 2% of Americans. But where I wouldn't agree with the caller is in saying that S&P is right. We can do hugely dysfunctional, hugely mistaken things. But if you ask the question, is the United States going to have the capacity to pay the interest and principal on its debt? I don't see that there's any basis for doubting that capacity on the part of the United States. And so if it was a matter of giving a grade on a report card, Washington would deserve a grade way, way below A. But if it's a matter of rating debt, I think that debt should still have the highest rating.
Well, of course, if you're a citizen, who wants a government doing, as you say, hugely dysfunctional things? Larry Summers, listen with us for just a second here to a couple of views of what's just happened. Here was Massachusetts Senator John Kerry. This was on Meet the Press on Sunday. He pointed the finger in one direction on the downgrading of the U.S. credit rating.
I believe this is, without question, the Tea Party downgrade. This is the Tea Party downgrade because a minority of people in the House of Representatives countered even the will of many Republicans in the United States Senate.
And here on the other side on Face the Nation, CBS, South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham, Senator, defended the Tea Party, put blame on the Obama White House.
The Tea Party didn't increase the deficit by 35%. The Tea Party is not the problem here. This president has failed to lead in any other private sector enterprise. He would be fired. If he was asking to be re-upped to run a football team, they wouldn't hire him.
He was your boss, Larry Summers. Put these two in the balance, the president's failure to lead and Lindsey Graham's allegation there, and John Kerry putting it all on the Tea Party downgrade. Where's the weight of responsibility lie here?
Okay, let's start with history. When I left office, having served as Bill Clinton's Treasury Secretary in 2001, the country had a $250 billion surplus. The debate was about the possibility of buying back all the government's debt and how the markets would function without Treasury securities.
Yeah.
That's what people were discussing.
Yeah.
In the 8 years when the other party was in control, things went terribly, terribly wrong. And Barack and Obama inherited both a massive budget deficit and a massive financial crisis that obviously, by driving the economy downwards, was going to enlarge the deficit. That is the overwhelming reason that we have larger budget deficits today. Decisions about fighting wars, decisions about tax cuts with no plan for recouping the revenue, entitlement programs that were authored during the years when George W. Bush was president. That's been, and President Obama has recognized, has been a central concern that he needs to address. But before we can address that deficit, we have to get the economy going. He was prepared to negotiate with anyone. He proposed that we negotiate difficult compromises in the United States, but that we not use the country's creditworthiness as a club to get our ways. It was only, as Senator Kerry said, the Tea Party that was insistent on that course.
Well, but to Lindsey Graham's point, I mean, the Tea Party could be wrong, and the president could be wrong as well. Failure of leadership, many even on the left are saying failure of leadership here.
The president has faced implacable opposition. You know, if you go back to January of 2009, and you look at what had been happening to the stock market, what had been happening to jobs, what had been happening to trade flows, a whole range of economic statistics, it was actually much worse than happened in the fall and winter, fall of 1929 and the winter of 1930. And where we are is completely unacceptable. We have a long way to go. But, you know, it's not the kind of total collapse that we saw in the 1930s. And that was what was in train. And the president and his leadership and his policies contained all of that. And I think for that, he deserves a great deal of credit. It is always very hard to win an argument where you say, where you're saying it could have been worse. But in this case, that is actually the reality. And the president actually has put in place a set of policies that have contained the damage. Frankly, we would be in a much better position today if the president's program in its original form had been able to pass the Congress. We would be in a better place if the further measures the president proposed in the fall of 2009 had been able to pass the Congress. We would be in a better place if we had avoided this spectacle of being downgraded by not facing the kind of threats that came from the House majority this in the last several weeks. So the president has, I believe, been dealt an almost impossible hand and has showed real capacity in containing a phenomenally dangerous economic situation, in laying a foundation for things this country has needed to do for a long time, like reforming financial regulation, and making health care available more broadly. And I believe even in this last very difficult period, without the skill he displayed, we might have been looking at a situation where the country was actually telling people that because it couldn't resolve its differences, it wouldn't pay its bills.
Well, I mean, we
and
can see
the president gets a lot of credit in my book for all of that.
We can see the impossible hand that he was dealt. We can see the implacable opposition. But I don't know about the sterling leadership side of this equation. I don't know. I think that's an open question. Michael in Charleston, South Carolina. You're on the air, Michael.
Thank you. I think it's just disgusting. I'm hearing Mr. Sumner talk about the same old things. Hello? Yeah. Talk about the same old things.
Yeah.
Hello?
Hello. What same old things?
Repeating what President Obama was talking about for the stimulus package, to do this, to do that, with billions and billions of dollars. We had nearly $800 billion spent on a stimulus package, and yet what can we really show for it? They'll cite things, this and that. But in general, we shouldn't pass another stimulus package until we have an accounting for where the money went the first time.
But, Michael, we don't have a Great Depression. If we throw the brakes completely on spending or do cut, cap, and balance as was proposed and you know really pull the plug on that, what about the real risk that we go into another major recession here? I mean, you're going to pull back just when there's no consumer demand already? Really?
Government cannot create jobs. It can provide services with jobs that are entailed with that. Jobs are created by the private sector. taking more money out of people's pockets and putting it in the government's pockets leads to waste. We have the Secretary of Treasury, Tim Geithner. He's criticizing the S&P for their analysis of our economy and what they did, and yet he can't even pay his own taxes properly.
Michael, we've got it. Larry Summers, you know, John Keynes is in the hot seat here, at least from the Republican perspective in the last year or so. Keynesian economics, you know, prime the pump and goose it when it's down with government spending doesn't work, people are saying now. You're the economist. What do you say?
All of the evidence. Look at the parts of the country where there was the most spending and there was the least, and you'll see a very big difference in the impact on employment. Look at the countries that moved most radically towards stimulus, and you'll see a big difference in you'll see a greater impact on levels of employment and output. It's a mystery to me how the caller could say that people who work for the government don't have jobs. When I worked in the White House, I was proud of the job I was doing. When I was Secretary of the Treasury, I was proud of the people who worked at the IRS, who worked very hard to serve their fellow citizens.
But isn't he right that at the end of the line, it's
the law?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
But isn't he right that at the end of the chain, it's the private sector that has to produce the revenue that pays for all that and keep the engine going?
Ultimately, in an economy like ours, it depends upon the private sector, and what we need to do is stimulate the private sector and to help the private sector to spend more. That's why the government is engaged in a whole set of the policies it's engaged in. That's why there have been reduced taxes for those starting small businesses. That's why there are increased incentives for capital investment. That's why when the government improves our infrastructure and makes basic public investments, how does it do it? It does it by buying products and goods and services from private companies. This wasn't about some socialist experiment where the government was going to do things itself. This is what is the program that the president passed in the Recovery Act? It's basically the government buying more from the private sector. That's helping the private sector.
And here we are, Joan in Newton, Massachusetts. You're on the air with Larry Summers, Joan.
Hi. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
What I would like to know is why the Republicans and the Tea Party especially are blaming Obama about this. The Constitution gives the whole responsibility of the purse strings, the budget, et cetera, to Congress. The president is not responsible for anything. He is not responsible for putting a plan on the table. He is not responsible for leading. He has facilitated in his meetings.
Joan, we're up against a break here. Let me let your point hang right there. I hear you on the Congress responsibility, but surely, especially in difficult times, the president has a gigantic responsibility to lead. Look back through our history and how important that was. Larry Summers is with us. He wrote, "There is still time to confirm Churchill's maxim that the United States always does the right thing after exhausting all the alternatives." I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour with former Treasury Secretary and top economic advisor to President Barack Obama, Larry Summers, about the economy in a time of crisis. What got us here? What might get us out? Larry Summers, John Harwood was in for me here last week, and I appreciate that. He's writing today talking with Reischauer, Bob Reischauer, former director of the Congressional Budget Office. And Bob Reischauer is saying, you know what, the good times are over, more or less, that we got accustomed to kind of standard of living and economic growth in this country after World War II that we're not in a position to regain. We're going to have a long period of turbulence, and it's going to be very grim. Is that it? Is that what we're looking at?
Certainly, this is not going to be has been in many ways, the worst period of economic performance since the Second World War for the United States. And I don't think we can be confident that it's over. I said many times while I was in government that our problems were not made in a day or a week or a month or a year. They're not going to be solved in a day or a week or a month or a year. What I think the American people should seek from their government is a clear strategy for moving forward. And they should look for progress on the economy. But it is absolutely right to say that this is going to be a difficult period. In many ways, it's going to be a difficult period because of the tremendous excesses that were built up prior to this period. We built an excessive number of homes. We built an excessive number of shopping centers. We invested and borrowed in an unsustainable way, and the result now is going to be a weaker economy.
What about, I mean, look at that history. You brought up a number of points of history. What about the deregulatory move of the 90s? You were part of it. How do you look back on that now? Was that a mistake?
Look, I don't think there's any question that if we had 20, with the benefit of perfect foresight, many of the changes that were put in place in 2009, 2010, in the Dodd-Frank legislation, it would have been better if they had been put in place earlier. And many of them, if they had been put in effect, I think would have mitigated or possibly prevented the crisis that we saw. So there's no question that people didn't see this coming, and certainly in the form that it took going back in the 1990s, I didn't see this kind of crisis developing late in the decade of the 2000s. On the other hand, I think the critics have gone way far on a number of dimensions and rather beyond what is supported by the evidence in blaming the actions in the 1990s. Let's be clear. The financial authorities of the post-2000 period fell far short of even using the authorities that were open to them to regulate banks, to do things about derivatives, to address too big to fail, to reform Fannie and Freddie. So I think it is very unlikely that even if they had had somewhat more authorities because the laws had been written somewhat differently in the 1990s, since they didn't even use the authorities they did have, it's very, very unlikely that they would have used more authorities to do anything that was very constructive during the 2000 period. So we could have, I think it would frankly bore your listeners to tears, we could discuss the various technicalities associated with Glass-Steagall reform or with respect to derivatives reform. And certainly I would say those various types of issues are in a much better place now than we were able to leave them in 1998, 1999, 2000. But I would very much take issue with those who suggest that somehow if different laws had been written in ways that, you know, we tried on many different dimensions, but the Republican Congress simply wouldn't permit any increased regulation in the late 1990s. I find it very hard to believe that there's anything we could feasibly have done that, given the attitudes and approaches taken by financial policymakers between 2001 and 2007, would have made any difference. But certainly I, for one, wish that we had foreseen this all much more accurately.
Let me ask you, I think so many Americans these days feel almost at sea here. There's such a huge gap between sort of Tea Party view of the world and, let's say, the president's, despite his openness to negotiation. you know, he put out his agenda and was tarred as a socialist by some on the right. On the other hand, you've got people who look at the Republican agenda and have said, you know, this is a way to turn us into a anything-goes kind of second Pakistan or banana republic. I mean, if you look back across our last, I don't know, century of political history, you know, where's the right balance for us now? Is FDR, LBJ, Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton? What, you know, what's the compass setting? I think people have kind of lost sight of what it ought to be.
Look, I think the right philosophy is that we have learned, and the lesson of the 20th century, if you looked at what happened in Russia or China before it reformed, if you looked at the difference between West Germany and East Germany, many other comparisons, is that market-oriented systems work best to enhance people's freedom and opportunity and to get them the goods and services they want for their families. We've also learned that market systems alone don't work, that they collapse, that they are prone to huge instability, that they become corrupt without satisfactory legal enforcement, that there are a variety of problems. The environment is perhaps the classic example, that they're unable to solve without a role for government. And so while it's an old idea, it's a good idea that we have a mixed economy that respects the role of the market, but in which government is prepared to act.
Can we still afford that?
And
China.
We can. And
but China's now saying.
And it's proper, by the way, that there be debates about just what the boundaries are in that mixed economy, and there will be reasonable differences of opinion. Democrats like me tend to be more concerned with fairness and tend to be less concerned with the possibility that if you have tax rates at the level we had in the 1990s, somehow everybody will be disincentivized to work. Republicans, in many cases, believe less in government seeking to make the society fairer and more in the basic property rights of individuals to hold on to what they earn, and in the adverse incentive effects that come if you raise taxes. And that's what political arguments are about. Where I think we are put at risk is the situation where people use tactics to try to lever and insist on getting their way. And I think the new and disturbing element is not ideological argument. Roosevelt had that with Landon. Johnson had that with Goldwater. Reagan had that with Mondale. Ideological argument has always been part of our system. What is new, different, and disturbing is the my way or I'll send the country into default. That's a new dimension. And that came from the broad group associated with the Tea Party and beyond. And I think that's new and dangerous, less because their views about how government should function are dangerous, though they're not views I share, but their attitude towards democracy. Democracy depends on citizens having a commitment to the process, to fighting within the process, but to not seeking to suspend the process or overwhelm the process if they're not getting their way. And that is what I find disturbing about the events of the last several months.
Where we've just been. Columbus, Ohio. Greg, you're on the air with Lawrence Summers.
Hey, just wanted to say there's several problems going on. One of the big ones that a lot of people are forgetting is that the Republicans, the Tea Party, all those guys, if you think back, what was their number one argument? We want to make sure Obama is a one-time president. People are forgetting that. They have no desire, no plans or anything to work with the man, to help the man out. Their number one goal, and you can look back on film, is to make sure he is a one-term president. I really wish two things. One, our first black president wouldn't have came after Bush because Bush messed it up so bad that no matter whom the president would have been, he and or she had an uphill battle. You cannot correct the problems that was created in 8 years, along with stealing an election on top of it. You cannot correct that in 2 years, 3 years, or 4 years.
Greg, we got the point. Let me put it to Larry Summers. He worked with Barack Obama a lot in the White House, and now here this weekend after the big downgrade, Lawrence Summers, the New York Times illustration shows Barack Obama's boxing gloves sort of hung up as though this president has kind of given up. Now, our caller says the Republicans just want him out. That's all it's about. But what about those who look at the president and say, come on, man, where's your fight?
I think you'll find that this president has a lot of fight in him. I think you'll find that this president is a president who, more than the vast majority of political figures I've known, has a compass and has a set of beliefs about where the system needs to go, but keeps his eye on the long run rather than steering to matters of immediate and short-term convenience.
In the long run, we're all dead.
In the long run, I think we need to wait before we make judgments on this debt deal. He could no doubt have found ways to look stronger, but if he had, he might have risked a breakdown in those negotiations that would have put the nation at peril. And he leads based on where he thinks we need to go over time, not on what will be most expedient for his image at a particular point in time. And so I would just encourage everyone to avoid rushing to judgment.
Larry in Stamford, Connecticut. You're on, Larry. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for the discussion.
Yes, sir.
I agree with Larry Summers that on purely economic grounds, the Standard & Poor's downgrade was justified.
He says not justified on purely economic grounds.
Excuse me?
He says not justified on purely economic grounds.
I believe that it is justified on economic grounds. I mean, the United States certainly can serve its debt.
Yeah, okay. All right.
And on that basis, it's justified. But I'm calling to say that I think that economic argument is beside the point. I think the point of the Standard & Poor's downgrade is to insist that the debt and deficit problem be dealt with now rather than later. I think the disgraceful behavior of Congress was all about the parties positioning themselves for the next election and postponing really dealing with the debt and the deficit until after the election.
Right now. Larry, we've got that. Let me get one more, if I may, Larry. I appreciate your call. Vivian, Harrisonburg, Virginia. Vivian, you're on.
Yes. I think we need to focus on how to fix this. And it seems we need to get the people sitting on the dollars, the companies sitting on trillions in China, to start releasing their money. They're just sitting on it because the dollar will be worth the same next year. If we just print enough dollars so that the average wage rises 1% quarterly, then the value of the dollar will go down next year, and these people sitting on it will put it into the system, and companies will start hiring workers.
Well, we'll see. Vivian, our time is short. Let me take it. Larry Summers, you said earlier, I mean, the last resort is print money as a way out of some of this debt problem. What is that? What it's going to take, and what about the inflation that would come with that?
I think the risks in the United States have been and continue to be much more on the side of stagnation of the kind that Japan suffered in the 1990s and in this decade than they are on the side of the kind of inflation and stagnation that the United States suffered in the late 1970s. And so I share the impulse towards a more expansionary approach that's behind what the caller's saying. You can debate how best to do it, and there are a variety of technical issues for the Federal Reserve at a time when interest rates are zero. But the basic impulse to more expansionary policy, I think, is correct.
When are we going to know if we've got another recession on the way?
We'll know much more than we know now 6 months from now.
No question of that. Lawrence Summers, former U.S. Treasury Secretary, Chairman of the Economic Advisors to President Barack Obama. We appreciate your spending the time with us today. Thank you very much, Larry.
Thank you. Bye.
Larry Summers, Lawrence Summers. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. It's great to be back with you. I'm sorry it's in such tough circumstances. Let's dig in and see what we can figure out and do. 800-423-8255. Call us tomorrow. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Good to be back. This is On Point.